So this evening, I would like to talk about contentment. And contentment is a very important part of Buddhist training, very important part of what supports meditation practice and Buddhist spiritual practice in general. It's seen most explicitly in the training of Buddhist monastics, monks and nuns, who are specifically taught to practice contentment. And it takes various forms. It takes contentment with the few possessions that they're allowed to have, to be content with those things, with the bare requisites for having what the Buddha considered a comfortable life. But that's not a comfortable life in some of the places we know around here. But to have just enough food to support the body in a good way, so it's good energy and not lethargic, not eating too much, not too little, just the right amount. To have just the right amount of clothes to do what clothes are most importantly need to do, which is to keep us protected from the elements so we don't get too cold. If we have enough clothes to keep us warm enough and protected from the mosquitoes enough. Things like, having the right clothes to attract the right spouse or partner wasn't part of the, part of the idea for monks and nuns. Be content with what looks like just kind of a curtain draped around them. And then to be content with very simple dwellings, just enough, just the right amount of dwelling, kind of size and shape and everything, to sleep properly and be protected again from the elements and keep your few possessions that you had. And to be content with the medicines the Buddha allowed. The Buddha allowed the monastics certain number of medicinal plants and things. And to be content with that. So to be content with very little. So it's pretty much a pretty Spartan life from our point of view, kind of lay life in the West. But from his point of view, as I've said, it was a life that had everything that the person needed to be comfortable in order to live life in life dedicated to spiritual practice. It was certainly not meant to be an ascetic life, though that's what it might seem like from our point of view. They didn't have VCRs, for example. DVD, I guess. The other thing was to be content with what was given. And that specifically had to do with a number of things, but Buddhist monastics lived mostly on what was given to them. They're not allowed to keep the food that they are given every day after 12 o'clock noon. So they have to be given food before noon, and they can't buy food for themselves, and they can't grow food for themselves. So they're completely dependent on the goodwill of people who want to feed them. So they wake up in the morning, and they don't know where their food's going to come from, and they put on their robes, and they have this bowl, and they go walking through the villages or the towns or the countryside. And at least in Southeast Asia, people understand what's going on. And they see the monks coming in the morning with their bowls. And they know the monks are out on their alms rounds. And people will then put food in. And here in the West, if you sort of walk down El Camino wearing your Buddhist robes, there might be some people who understand. The Thai restaurant on El Camino and Broadway, I went in there to eat one day only to find out the owners know Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano, the monastics in our tradition who live up in Ukiah. So you never know, who you went into in El Camino. When Ajahn Sumedho did this in England, he was walking through some park in England on his alms rounds, and mostly in walking in England, in London, they didn't get anything in the 70s. It was part of the tradition to walk the alms rounds. And they came back empty, and that's the way it went. But one day he was walking through London, and this jogger or bicyclist saw him and thought he was kind of odd. This guy with a shaved head and this kind of orange-like robe and sandals probably, and probably stuck out a little bit unusual in England where people were dressed a little bit differently. And so the guy stopped and said, "Who are you? What's going on?" And Ajahn Sumedha said, "Oh, I'm a forest monk. And I, every day, it's my custom to go out on alms round in case someone wants to make a donation to feed me." And he said, "Well, I don't have any food to give you. But since you're a forest monk, can I put a forest in your alms bowl?" And he had some property in some place in England where it was became Chithurst. I guess in Chithurst, England. I don't know exactly how it works, but the names of it. But he had this property, this house and some woods, and I guess next to a pond. And he gave it to him. And it became the first monastery in this Ajahn Sumedha's tradition in England. And that grew. And eventually they had like 6 or 7 places, monasteries in England, thriving monastic community. And so the monastics are kind of just given things. And sometimes they're given a lot. You know, they're given monasteries, you know, property. But sometimes they're given very little. And the practice of monastics is to be content with what's given. And if what you're given is poor quality, you're just content with that. If what you're given is not as good as the other monk down the street, you don't get envious and jealous, because that just upsets your own samadhi. But you're just content with what you do, what you have. So the idea of being content with what you have. Nowadays, there's a kind of a cliche, almost a piece of wisdom that I think is kind of profound, which is happiness doesn't come from getting what you want, but from being content with what you have, being happy with what you have. So rather than looking beyond yourself and beyond the present moment into some future present, into some future situation where you get something or get what you want, or, you know, you're putting your happiness off in the future, you find your happiness here and now, or your contentment here and now. The word, Pali word for contentment, is also can mean happiness or satisfaction. So to find your happiness or your contentment with what is already here. And this has been very important for me in the years of my practice. The idea of contentment, the practice of it, the experience of it. And it's been important when I can experience it, when I'm in touch with it. It's also been important when I'm not in touch with it, when I feel the opposite, when I feel discontented. And it's been important also when they both kind of coexist together, a feeling of contentment and a feeling of discontent at the same time. It's hard for me to kind of describe what contentment is for me. Maybe for each person it's different. Maybe a different situation is different. But I sense of it as almost a physical experience. So it's kind of almost like an emotional experience. It's not just some kind of idea of being content with how things are, but it's a deep sense of well-being that arises. It's almost like a feeling of a smile in my body. Not a smile on my face, but kind of a smile, kind of like, you know, in my torso, kind of. Or a sense of well-being, or a kind of peacefulness. A sense of being, a deep sense of satisfaction or peacefulness that somehow seems to permeate, when it's really strong, will permeate kind of my torso, my body, kind of my being. The first time I had this kind of experience was not through Buddhist meditation or through Buddhism at all. But the first time I had it in a very, I don't know, maybe that wasn't the first time I've had it, but I guess I've had other earlier times in my life. But the one time that was very important for me and kind of opened a door for me that was very important was when I was 18. And I was traveling around Europe by myself. And I came to in France, Mont Saint Michel. You know Mont Saint Michel? It's kind of like, looks like, you know, Walt Disney built it. Because you're going across the plains of Brittany, I think it is, or Normandy or something. You're going across the, and it's all flat. And then you suddenly see in the distance this this kind of like palace or castle-like thing that kind of was rising up to a spiral point, as I remember, kind of just rising up this high thing. And it's a piece of land. It's kind of like when the tide is in, it's an island. And when the tide is out, it's kind of like connected to the mainland. It's kind of this long, flat title, Flatland or something. And it's kind of this other, it's this huge monastery cathedral built on this mound or this hill, this little mountain. And apparently it was a sacred site before the Christians came to the area. But as Christians had a custom of doing, they often appropriated pagan Christian sites and made them into, you know, Christian sites, churches. And the first thing they did on this site was they built a small little chapel out of rocks, rock chapel, stone chapel. And it was relatively small, like, I don't know how, I was inside. It was probably, 12 by 8 maybe, that, pretty small, maybe a little bit bigger. Maybe some of you have been there. Have you been inside the little teeny chapel, the middle of it? Anyway, then over the centuries, they added to it, added until you had this huge, I don't know if it's a monastery, a cathedral, what it is, but monastery. But the original chapel is right still in the middle, still there. And so they had this tour of Mont Saint-Michel, and when they took us into that little chapel, as soon as I entered the chapel, I was just flooded with a sense of well-being and peace. It was a cool place, I don't know, or a power place. I don't know what it was. I never thought about it, what it was exactly, except that I felt this tremendous deep sense of contentment, of peace, of well-being that was just here. And it showed me a possibility of what I had never really taken seriously before that time. A possibility of some very deep, abiding, physical sense of being at peace or being contented or being at home or being kind of satisfied with this very moment now, with this body now, this situation right now. When I came to meditation, started doing meditation some years later, I started feeling the same thing there. Sometimes in just small hints of it, the corners of my being. And at times, it became stronger and stronger in meditation. And to this day, now it's become a very important part of my meditation practice. Not that it's always there in some powerful way, but even my daily sitting, I feel some level of contentment and peace. But it becomes a reference to me, for me, the idea of contentment, the idea that it's possible to be content, to be happy right now without anything happening. Without acquiring anything, without attaining anything, and a kind of strange way of saying this, without experiencing anything. Even though contentment might be kind of an experience. Like, you're not trying to be happy or trying to get concentrated or trying to do all these things. It's not about trying to get something out there, but rather it's almost like relaxing into what is already here and being okay with it. Being okay with this. So as I was sitting with you now today, this evening, there was a... my mind wasn't that settled today, sitting here. So my mind was wandering somewhat. And I had some choices I could have to my wandering mind. One was to be upset. I should, this shouldn't be happening to someone who's been meditating as long as I have. And, and I'm a meditation teacher, and if these people find out, it's pretty embarrassing. And so, or I could kind of, feel like, this is, I could have all kinds of negative attitudes to his wandering mind. But rather, what I did was to be content. Where's the contentment with this right now? Can I be content? Not necessarily content with the wandering mind, but just content in this moment, in this situation as it is, including the wandering mind. And when I come back to that sense of being content with how things are, then it's actually a lot easier to be mindful and be present. And it's a lot easier for the mind to let go of the wandering mind, that distracted mind. But if I enter into a conflict with my wandering mind, and are fighting it and trying to push against it and trying to stop myself from doing it, I find it doesn't often work very well for me to let the mind settle. The mind settles and becomes clear when we're not in conflict with it. And so asking myself, where's the contentment here with this? Or can I be content with this also, this situation here, was important just in the last sitting for me. at times in my life where I feel discontented. And then the reference of knowing that contentment is possible, that I've had a lot of experience in my life of finding contentment in situations where, you know, were unpleasant. Where can I find the contentment in an unpleasant situation now? What does it take? What do I have to understand about myself? What do I have to look at? What do I have to be honest about? What do I have to relax into? It becomes kind of like a question or a kind of a probing challenge. Where does it take? It's possible now. And in this difficult situation, where is it? And again, to just a couple hours ago, I had this question, this challenge. We came back from the East Coast after being there for 10 days, long enough for my one-year-old and six-year-old child to be acclimatized to that time zone. And by 5 o'clock this evening, it was 8 o'clock back east, and they're in bed by then. And it's 5 o'clock here. And a one-year-old and a six-year-old who's ready for bedtime, it is, at least in my family, it lends itself to unpleasantness. And it's one thing to have one unpleasantness. But when you have two unpleasantness connected to children, there's a kind of exponential growth of unpleasantness. It's not like 1 + 1, but it's like 1 to the 10th. So where, you know, how to be content here? How to be at peace or at ease with this, to accept this, to relax this, to be with this? Oh, there's just this. And engage in it and try to take care of it. You know, you can't just, you know, just letting go doesn't quite work. You have to also kind of act. You have to do something. This is a big surprise to me as being a parent, you know, was the shortcoming of my years of retreat practice. Luckily, I trained in Zen, so I got the other half pretty well. But I see this in people who haven't done Zen, you know, people done a lot of Vipassana practice, which is what I teach nowadays, right? So you can be really good at sitting there on the cushion on the retreat and learning how to let go, let go, let go, let go, because nothing's asked of you. I mean, no one's asking you to entertain a six-year-old. Or, you know, change the diaper of a one-year-old who doesn't want... You know, have you ever tried to change a diaper of a one-year-old who doesn't want to change a diaper? I mean, they didn't teach me wrestling in high school. And you can't reason with them because... and you have to change that diaper. You know, it's like... There's a term called blowouts. When the diaper hasn't, you know, contained. And then the baby doesn't want to sit still, right? And so you can't just sit there and be quiet and say, it's okay. I'll just be content with this situation. I'll just let go. I know how to be peaceful. You know, it takes certain kind of, you have to do something. And I've seen in some Vipassana students that they fall back on just kind of this being receptive mode. And in Zen, what I learned was there's also a way of being active and engaged. And so where is the peace? Where is the contentment? Where is it in engaging in a situation that needs engagement? How do we do that? And I find it still to this day in certain situations, you know, the wrestling situations. You know, very difficult, you know, to do that. But the reference that it's possible is very important for me. And then I pay attention to where am I tense? Where am I anxious? What's going on with me that's not the contentment? And then, you know, can I relax that? Can I let go of that? I had a conversation today with a woman who's done a lot of meditation practice. Very good practitioner. Done a lot of long retreats. And she was telling me about the recent retreat she's been on, and she's learned a new, you know, she's learned a new technique. She learns different techniques, different, you know, times. She learned a new technique, a meditation practice, and that technique helped her a lot. And she read some spiritual book, and she had a new understanding that helped her a lot, and all these things, and it helped her a lot in her practice. And I listened to all this, and I was happy for her. It was really great to hear how she'd been helped. But listening to it, you know, I was at the end of the conversation, I said, this is all really great. It makes me very happy. But in listening to this, what I've heard, is, and don't take this wrong, I said to her, because it sounds simplistic or reductionistic, but it's not meant that way. But what I've heard is that you've learned all these techniques, these new techniques, this new understanding, and what they've done for you, what each of them has done for you, is it helped you relax. The technique helped you relax. This understanding helped you relax. And you just needed to relax. And you know, you went to these expensive retreats and, you know, learned these wonderful techniques. They've been honed down through the centuries. And it just gave her, it just was the way of encouraging her, just relax. It's okay. Everything's okay. Just relax. Just relax and let things take their own course. She discovered that she had a capacity to have a lot of joy in her practice. If she just got out of the way of the joy. She'd been resisting it, not liking it. She had a feeling that joy was not an appropriate thing to feel because, well, whatever. And relaxing is a real big key to meditation practice. And part of relaxing, or kind of part of that family of things which is connected to relaxation, is being content with how things are. Is it possible? And then honestly look at, why is it not possible? Why do you think it's not possible? What do you feel like you need? Where do you think happiness is found? Is happiness found in chasing after something or seeking after something? Or is happiness something that is expressed through us? Is happiness something that arises because we get something? Or is happiness something that is simply an expression of some inner sense of well-being? And I think that the path of Buddhist meditation is to begin discovering the happiness which is an expression of who we are rather than an expression of having gotten something that makes us happy. So what is that? How is that defined that? So part of contentment is a, for me at times, at the best, is a kind of relaxing into maybe what can be called a spacious mind or a still mind. Or a transparent mind, or open mind, a mind that has no boundaries, a mind that has no awareness, which has no boundaries, or has no inside, no outside, a mind which is at home or at peace with itself. One of the remarkable things for me about spiritual life as I've learned it is that is the difference between motivations or intentions or activities of the mind or things I want to do that come from my egotistical mind or my self-centered mind, or the mind that feels like it has to control things or make things happen or is seeking something outside of itself. So that's on one hand, versus the kind of motivation or action in the world that just seems to arise seemingly spontaneously on its own. Sometimes I call it the innate intelligence of the mind. So not figuring things out or planning or but rather kind of trusting that what needs to happen will arise on its own. You know, no one's going to pee for you. So, you know, most of us know that when it's time to pee, you know, we have the intelligence to do it. We trust our innate intelligence for the most part to pee, right? So can we do that same thing with, you know, with other things and having a conversation with someone? Do you have to plan the conversation ahead? Or can you just let things just arise by itself out of a mind which is relaxed, out of a mind which is already content with how things are? If we feel anxious or discontented by how things are and then act or speak out of that discontentment, I don't think the chances are that our actions and our speech is going to be as wise and as conducive to peace as if we can speak and act from the place of contentment. But to do that requires a certain level of trust that what comes out of contentment is adequate to take care of ourselves, take care of the situation. So to practice contentment with the things that we have, not because it's a moral thing to do in Buddhism, but because if you can let your mind start becoming content more and more often, it's a lot easier to dive deep into the spiritual dimensions of our minds and hearts. When the mind is discontented with your bank account or your house or your clothes or your partner or lack of it or whatever, there's not much space to experience the depth of our spiritual psyche. So it's not a moral thing to practice contentment with things we have, but rather it's a strategy that if you can be more content with how things are in your life, it kind of like opens the door in your mind for some new possibility to happen, of being able to relax and go deeper into some deeper sense of peace and well-being. So there's contentment with the kind of things of your life, and then there's contentment with just what's happening in this moment. And then there's contentment with what's happening in meditation, with your distracted mind, or with your breath when it's uncomfortable, or the quality of your breathing right now. You know, to be content with how things are, as opposed to looking beyond what's here and now for something else or seeking beyond the present. So maybe that's enough. Hopefully my innate, spontaneous intelligence and contentment was adequate enough. You're all contented with it. You leave all contented with the talk. The talk doesn't have to be good for you to be contented. And I was thinking earlier today I would maybe talk about contentment. And when I thought about it, I thought maybe that's a nice topic to follow the theme of the last two Mondays. So, do you have any questions or comments? Dick?
Could you wait for the microphone, please?
Oh.
I kind of hate to bring this up in a way because I'm sure several others in this room are politically active. And if we get too contented, then what happens to what good we can do with reference to our government?
So someone told me that in Thailand, I've heard different stories. One person told me it was in the 1950s, and someone else told me it was more recently, that the government in Thailand had a law passed, I guess, whatever, decree, that Buddhist teachers had to, were no longer allowed to teach teachings on contentment. Because then people wouldn't be, you know, industrious and, you know, and, you know, work hard to build the economy and all that. And someone, when I gave a talk on contentment, you know, some years ago, and someone afterwards told me that this is not good for corporate America, because what they want, if you have in your resume, you know, your good qualities, and you say you have great capacity for being content, you're not going to get hired, because they want someone who's driven and who's ambitious and wants to really, you know, be competitive and all that, probably. So so there could be, you know, some problems with contentment. There's a lot to be said about it. Maybe the benefits are greater than the problems. But the most important thing to say in response is that a deep, abiding sense of contentment doesn't preclude being politically active. It means that when you're politically active, that you're not doing it from a place of anxiety, despair, agitation concerning what's going on.
Can we say that acceptance is leads to contentment?
Does acceptance lead to contentment? The right kind of acceptance does.
Acceptance of situation, whatever situation you are in,
yeah.
You just accept it as it is.
Yeah. It's a little bit dangerous. I mean, it's kind of like what, you know, point Dick was making, right? I mean, we just, you know, someone's hitting you over the head with a brick, you know, and, oh, I'll just accept this one too. You know, that's kind of silly, right? And there's a wonderful book now out called Radical Acceptance that kind of uses that term, radical acceptance, as almost a kind of a description of mindfulness practice or how it unfolds. I like to think of non-harming or non-violence as being a good, better expression than acceptance. To not be in conflict with what's going on, as opposed to accepting it. Because some things we don't want to. Some things are important not to accept. But even when we don't accept it, we don't have to be in conflict with it. Even when we're trying to stop it, even when we say no to it. So maybe it sounds a little strange to talk this way. Maybe explain a little bit further. There's a difference between what we do with our speech and our actions and what we do with our mind. The mind can get contracted. The mind can shut down. The mind can get filled with hate and aversion and desire. The mind can do all these things. Acceptance is primarily a quality, as a Buddhist practice, a quality of the mind. The mind itself is going to be open and accepting and receptive to this experience. The mind is not going to get contracted or tight or aversive to this situation. What you decide to do in terms of acting or speaking in a situation is a different question. But you're not going to sacrifice the peacefulness of the mind, even when you have to say no. Even maybe when your life's at stake, you still might say no. You still might, you know, put up your hand and stop the brick. You might do all kinds of things, but the mind itself is accepting of it. So the mind is accepting, but not our actions are maybe not, or our judgment is maybe not. Is that distinction helpful? Is that helpful, or is that too complicated?
Yeah, you could. I guess I would put it this way that. We can accept it and do some action, not because I don't accept it, but because it's wisdom. It's wise to take an action, whatever it is.
Right.
But I accept, first thing I accepted, and then I take action, not because I'm not accepting, but because it is wise.
Beautiful, yeah. So I would say the greater the acceptance, healthy form of acceptance, the greater the wisdom, the greater chances that wisdom has to operate. And this is this thing I'm pointing to, this idea of the innate intelligence. I have a great kind of confidence in kind of some innate intelligence, innate wisdom that sometimes can operate when we're relaxed enough, we're accepting enough. But I've made a fool of myself enough to know that. So, is that enough? Are you all contented? Enough? So I hope it's been helpful, and you might take this as a challenge for this next week to see what the role contentment might have in your life and how you can use contentment, the theme of contentment, the idea of it, and the experience of it as a way to facilitate the deepening of your happiness in your life. So, thank you.